The Ohio primary is behind us, and the 2024 general election begins. While President Biden and former President Donald Trump had already locked in nominations for a rematch in November, all eyes were on the Republican primary in the race for U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown's seat. Businessman Bernie Moreno will now face Brown in a contest that'll decide the balance of power in Washington, D.C. next year. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. Ahead, we'll discuss the results of the primary with a panel of political experts, including State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Later, we'll hear a discussion on the efforts to improve health outcomes for Black women and babies. Experts at Kent State have found that untreated post-traumatic stress disorder and chronic stress play a critical role in high infant mortality rates. Those conversations are coming up. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Northeast Ohio businessman Bernie Moreno has won the expensive, bitterly fought Republican primary for U.S. Senate. He defeated State Senator Matt Dolan and Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose in a close race that went into Election Day with about a third of voters undecided. In the end, Moreno won with about 50% of the vote, with the endorsement of former President Trump in the three-way contest. Last night, Moreno, in speaking with Fox News, attributed his win to Trump's seal of approval.
An endorsement for President Donald J. Trump is the most powerful endorsement in modern political history. There's never been anything like it before. Probably won't be anything like it afterwards.
He will now face incumbent Sherrod Brown in November. It is a race that will be watched closely. Republicans need to flip 1 to 2 seats in the chamber to regain Senate control, and Brown's seat is viewed as one that the GOP believes it can win. But Brown, when talking to MSNBC last night, had this to say about Moreno and his deferring approach to the general.
Well, I'm going to run my own race. I'm not a pundit about who's going to vote how. I know that when I focus on taking on interest groups, when I focus on what we've done to fight back against what Norfolk Southern did to a lot of people in my state with that train derailment.
And while 2024 is a presidential election, both President Joe Biden and former President Trump secured enough wins prior to the Ohio primary to lock up their nominations. They were on the ballot and won their Ohio primaries. But the fact that the nominations had been settled may have kept some voters at home. Voter turnout was reportedly lower than the last presidential primary across Northeast Ohio. In Cuyahoga County, the Board of Elections put the turnout at less than 20%. So we're going to talk about primary results, including the Republican U.S. Senate primary, some congressional races, as well as some state house contests that had a number of Republican incumbents facing contentious challenges. Joining me to discuss the results of the Ohio primary in studio, we have Dr. Tom Sutton. He is the interim provost and a professor of political science at Baldwin-Wallace University. Thanks so much for coming in.
Good morning, Jenny. Good to be with you.
Always glad to have you. By phone, we have Dr. J. Cherie Strawn. She's a political science professor and director of the Bliss Institute of Applied Politics at the University of Akron. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
And from Columbus, we have Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Karen, thank you for working such a late night. How late a night was it for you?
It's still going on. I took a little nap, but I haven't really been to bed yet.
All righty. Well, hopefully you're doing okay, and we appreciate your time. So if you'd like to join the conversation, call 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. So I'd like to start with the race that was being watched nationally, the U.S. Senate Republican primary. First, Tom, what are your reactions to Bernie Moreno winning the primary?
Well, it certainly shows that Donald Trump, the former president, is the kingmaker of Ohio. So we saw his endorsement of J.D. Vance pulled Vance to the front and become the nominee in 2022, a race that Bernie Moreno was also a candidate in. And in this one also, we saw the same thing. A three-way race. LaRose, Frank LaRose, the Secretary of State, who had probably the best name recognition going into this race, but had the least amount of money because he didn't have the millions that Dolan and Moreno had.
And infused in the very last days, I'm reading.
Yes. So we saw literally in the last 10 days where we had the early vote fully underway, et cetera. a lot of advertising, just flooding the airwaves with monies, a couple of million that were put in by Marino and Dolan that at the end of the day pushed Marino ahead, but did not by slightly ahead. He won by 17 points over Matt Dolan.
So quite a lead.
Yes, it really was substantial. I think larger than many expected, because we saw in the presidential, even though we know Donald Trump locked it up and he got 79% of the vote, but that means that 21% of the voters for the Republican primary voted for somebody else, the lead, of course, being Nikki Haley.
Right.
That kind of result we thought might have some effect on this race, making it closer than it was. But when you look at the demographic split, it was like so many of these races in Ohio. You had the urbans and the suburban areas that went for Matt Dolan, but not by that much. And then you had basically Bernie Marino, the Trump-backed candidate, sweeping through all the rural areas in a low turnout election. Basically, that's what made the difference.
So do you think there was a closeness to the race maybe in the last three quarters of the race, and then he just pulled away, Marino did?
Well, I think as we've seen in the past, what happens is that Trump vote, those that are backing because they see that endorsement, may not have been quite as loud. We didn't see former President Trump in Ohio quite as much. He did come last Saturday.
Right.
I think that had an effect. It got people paying attention to that race. You also have that early votes do tend to be used more by in-person early votes by Republican than Democratic voters. Democrats tend to rely a little bit more on the mailed ballot. But even there, we saw very low response rates on those ballots coming in, only like a few hundred thousand going into this race. Ultimately, we had about a 1.6 million turnout out of 8 million registered voters in Ohio.
Sheree, wondering, does the closeness of the race, or I mean, as Tom is saying, actually, you know, Marino pulled it out by 70 points in the end. But what do you think the outcome says about the power of former President Trump and his influence in Ohio?
It absolutely, I agree, made the difference for these primary voters. It'll be interesting to see, you know, in the long run when we hit the general election, whether Moreno is capable of following the path of J.D. Vance, or whether he looks more like, you know, Blake Masters in Arizona, right? A MAGA endorsed Senate candidate who lost in Arizona, or Herschel Walker, who had the Trump endorsement in Georgia. You know, which path will voters take? You know, we know that the Democrats wanted Marino. They feel, you know, the Democrats, Brown's campaign, feel like they have a better shot at painting Marino as an extremist than they did Dolan. So it's interesting to see how that will play out, despite the Trump support in the primary, whether that carries over to the general.
Karen, I do think there is some earnest surprise in Marino pulling it out, and as strongly as we are hearing that he did. Twice Matt Dolan has run for U.S. Senate, going for the lane that didn't actively court Trump. What is your takeaway, and is that now firmly a losing strategy on the GOP side in Ohio?
Well, I think Dolan learned from the 2022 seven-way primary that he was in that being clear about his support for Trump was important. He did not actively seek Trump's endorsement, but he made it clear during the campaign that he would support Trump and Trump's policies. And so he was definitely not an anti-Trumper. And so I think that may have led some voters to look at him more than maybe they looked at Frank LaRose, who came into this race really is seen as being the front runner. He was the one that had the statewide name recognition. He had won twice in terms of running statewide, whereas Dolan had run statewide once and had come in third place. But when you look at the final results, it's really interesting. Marino won every county. He beat Dolan and LaRose in every county. Mm-hmm. And Marino's best counties were in the Youngstown area, Mahoning County, Trumbull County, which are counties that have gradually become more and more conservative. These are counties that Sherrod Brown had seen support in over the years, but that started to fade away. And so this is breaking down the results is really interesting to see where the Marino had strength throughout the state.
Let's hear from Marino following his win last night and the direction he says he wants the country to go.
People like President Trump in Ohio for a very good reason. When he was president, we had world stability, we had low interest rates, we had good wages going up. So things were objectively good when President Trump was in office, and they're really bad under President Biden.
And now, conversely, let's hear from Brown following Marino's win last night and how he sees the matchup against Marino generally.
My opponent thinks you legislate by just doing what you think you should do. And I don't think people trust that. They don't trust him on abortion. They don't trust him on ethics. They don't trust him on fighting, on taking on interest groups.
So, Tom, as you hear both men speak, are there thoughts about the approach to the general that you think these candidates are both going to stick to try to garner as many votes as they can?
Well, I think the number one issue that we're going to see talked about, despite the fact that it may not be the primary issue for a lot of people in their personal lives, is going to be immigration. That's the one that Republicans have had the best shot at winning. And then we saw recently in one of the other races where it was one of the New York races where to replace George Santos in that special election, we saw the Democratic candidate in that race really double down on the issue of immigration, taking a conservative stance on it, the need to really deal with this issue because of all of the migrants that were coming into New York City area. I think if you see Sherrod Brown perhaps take a page out of that playbook and other Democrats, you may see the blunting of that issue because it will certainly be used by Bernie Marino against Brown. Brown will focus on economics. He will focus on popular economics, looking at the programs that Biden has brought into the state, the money. And Marino, I think, is going to focus very much partly on that, but even more so on social issues. So really the culture war issues combined with immigration. And when it comes to the economy, what you just heard from one of the spokespeople, basically that the economy was great and everything was wonderful when Trump was president, and now everything is not, even though economists would tell you otherwise.
I am speaking with Tom Sutton from Baldwin Wallace University, Sheree Strawn with the Bliss Institute at University of Akron, and Karen Kassler, our News Bureau Chief at the State House in Columbus, about yesterday's primary results. Sheree, I'm curious, do you too see when talking about the primary, excuse me, when we're talking about the general election and this Senate race, that immigration is going to be an issue that Sherrod Brown is going to have to address, since it's so strongly being brought up all over the nation as being Biden's inefficacy when it comes to handling the border?
I don't think they can avoid talking about it. But in the same way that Democrats are going to need to blunt the issue of immigration, right, have an answer on immigration, Republicans and Moreno are going to need to have an answer on reproductive rights and abortion. I checked the NBC exit polls. 35% of Republican primary voters in Ohio are unhappy about the Dobbs decision. And 43% of Republican primary voters yesterday, so not, you know, not the overall electorate, but the Republican primary voters who are, you know, the most intense sort of active voters, especially in this low turnout environment, 43% opposed a federal ban. So in the same way that Democrats are going to have to come up with an answer on immigration and have things to say, Republicans are going to have to figure out what to say on reproductive rights. And a lot of people in Ohio, because of those ballot initiatives in the fall, you know, are paying attention, right? And we're sort of wired in to pay attention to those issues because they just voted on it twice.
Yeah, and we did see with issue one resounding support there. Karen, what do you think of that as an issue? Positioning abortion versus immigration, and how much each party has to focus on both.
I think that Marino is going to take his cues from Trump, as many Republican candidates around the country are, and that's a big issue for Trump. I mean, it's the reason that the bipartisan bill that was worked out in Congress did not go through, because Trump didn't want it to. He wanted to campaign on this issue. And so you're going to hear a lot about immigration. It's going to be a core part of Marino's campaign. But I think the issue of abortion is really a big deal in Ohio. I mean, in November, this red state voted to uphold abortion and reproductive rights. And Democrats are already hitting Marino for being on board with a national abortion ban. And now when I talked to him about that, he said he has been kind of cagey about exactly what he would support. But certainly you have to think that if the White House and the House and Senate all go Republican, a national abortion ban would be on the table. So Democrats are really hitting him on that, and I think that's going to be a key issue.
Okay, let's take a quick call from Robert in Brecksville. Robert, good morning. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. Yeah, and watching this campaign for the Senate on the Republican side, you know, when I watched these ads, which were just constant, I thought to myself, well, if the Republicans were smart, they would, you know, they'd pick Dolan because he's really doing a good job trying to pretend he's just as crazy as Bernie Moreno is. But no, they stuck to their Trump candidate. And you know, if you look at the race with J.D. Vance, you know, he had said some bad things about Trump before, and he ran the worst campaign in the world. But because he got the Trump endorsement, he got elected. To me, this is really a sad state of affairs. I think the Democrats make a mistake when they supported the Moreno campaign, thinking it's going to be the easiest to beat. Because you know, when it comes to the Trump endorsement, Ohio's just really gone down the red hole. And having been voting since I was 18, and I'm now 72, it's just really depressing to see what's happening to Ohio.
Robert, I appreciate your call. And I do want to ask, Tom, before we have to move on to a bunch of other races, what did you make of the spending of that Senate Majority PAC money trying to swing support to Moreno, seeing him as a more defeatable opponent for Brown in November?
Well, we have seen this kind of strategy be used before. The Democrats tried to use it in 2022 up in New Hampshire in that race. I think it's, quite frankly, a very risky strategy to get involved in another party by trying to weaken that candidate. I think some of the blowback might be what we've been hearing about in Ohio, where we'll go to a closed primary system, which wouldn't affect that money per se. But that whole idea that you're going to help the other party pick their candidate, it's a two-way street. You could see the same kind of thing happening with money going into the Democratic side to try to get them to pick a weak candidate. And that goes all the way back to 2004, when they were hoping that Dennis Kucinich would be the one picked to run against George Bush in his second term. It went nowhere, but I'm doubtful about it. It did have an effect, though, because it had an effect. It gave more attention to Moreno, and it probably helped him get to that 50%.
If you'd like to participate in the conversation, it's 866-578-0903 or soi@ideastream.org. Karen, let's talk about those contentious State House Republican primaries, part of this ongoing rift in Columbus. Give us a sense of how the so-called Blue 22 fared in these primary races. Those Republicans who worked with Democrats to elect Jason Stevens, how did they fare? All right, so we are missing Karen. We'll get back to that. Tom, let's move on to some of the congressional races. The 6th congressional district vacated by Bill Johnson. Tell us a bit about what happened there last night.
So that's the district where we saw Michael Rooley, state representative and former state senator Stoltzfus, running against each other. And then there was a third candidate in the race as well. A three-way race. It was definitely going to be whoever wins this essentially is winning the general, because it's a very strong Republican area, stretching from about Youngstown down along the Appalachian area to a part of southern Ohio. Rooley got 49.6%. Stoltzfus got 41%. A lot of money spent in this race. They're pretty evenly matched on that basis. And again, both veteran politicians. But it looks like Rooley will more than likely be the next congressman for the 6th district.
And then we've got the 13th congressional district, Cherie, where three Republicans ran for the chance to take the seat held by Amelia Sykes.
Yes, and Coughlin pulled it out. And so that will be the race that we see going forward with Amelia Sykes. And, you know, I'm new to the area. I have been in Ohio and in Akron for just under 2 years. And so, you know, I've been asking questions and, you know, pundits and local reporters and local political activists, and they think that Amelia Sykes has a pretty good shot at hanging on to that seat.
Well, this is how Coughlin's going to position himself. Republican Kevin Coughlin saying last night after his win of the primary, I believe in the market economy, in less government regulation, in lower taxes. I believe in accountable government. And I believe in not decriminalizing things, but recriminalizing things, because I think we've gotten way too soft on crime. So, Tom, curious, that position for Kevin to be running on, how do you think that will fare?
Well, it sounds like he's running more for mayor of one of the cities than he's run for Congress. But certainly the crime, the law and order type of thing makes him sound conservative, but at the same time appeals to moderate voters for whom the perception that crime is an issue is real. For some, it has been real. He is a veteran politician who's getting back into politics running for this seat. But I agree with Cherie that I think Amelia Sykes, I don't think it's going to be a strong win. It's going to be more competitive than it was 2 years ago when Sykes, as a well-known former minority leader of the Ohio House, ran against Madison Giotto Gilbert, who was really an untested state rep and ran a bad campaign. This will be a more competitive campaign, but I think it still gives the edge to Sykes.
All right, we have Karen back. Karen, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, so let's talk about this. Let's talk about the Blue 22, these contentious state House Republican primaries, and this rift in Columbus with the Republicans who worked with Democrats to elect Jason Stevens as Speaker. How did they fare last night?
Well, I did want to add one thing really quickly on the U.S. Senate race. I know that you've been kind of talking about the congressional races in the period that I was off the line, but this is on track to become the most expensive U.S. Senate race in state history. I mean, the spending already and the fundraising in this campaign has been huge, and it's only going to get bigger. So if I heard one of the callers talking about being sick of the ads, well, it's just going to pile up even more going forward. So. But when it comes to the Ohio House races, there were 11 incumbents in the Ohio House who were facing challengers this time, 11 Republican incumbents, and four of them lost. And for State House reporters, two of them are kind of big names. John Cross, who's from Findlay in Northwest Ohio, and Sarah Carruthers, who's from Southwest Ohio. Carruthers lost to a pastor of a far-right evangelical Christian church who's made some derogatory comments about LGBTQ people. And so that's one thing to note about Diane Mullins is her name. And then two Northeast Ohio area members of the House apparently lost their seats, Brett Hillier from Tuscarora County and Gail Pavliga from Portage County. And all four of these folks were people who supported Stevens over Derek Maron. Derek Maron, who was term limited and couldn't run for the House, he is now running for the U.S. House and actually won the primary last night in Northwest Ohio.
And then, Karen, moving on to the Ohio Supreme Court, Republicans hold a 4-3 majority, but there's an open seat, and that could be consequential this fall. Can you summarize what's going on with those elections?
Well, you've got Joe Dieters, who was appointed to the Ohio Supreme Court last year to serve out the rest of the term of Sharon Kennedy, who became Chief Justice when she and Jennifer Bruner, who's another justice, a Democratic justice, ran in 2022. And so Dieters is now running against Democrat Melody Stewart to try to get a full 6-year term. And so that leaves Dieters' seat open. And Dieters, the two Democrats who are vying for his seat, Lisa Forbes from the 8th District Court of Appeals beat Terry Jamison from the 10th District Court of Appeals. This is Jamison's essentially second loss since she ran in 2022 and lost as well. That means Lisa Forbes will face a Franklin County Judge Dan Hawkins in the fall. And then you also have Justice Michael Donnelly, a Democrat. He is running. He was unopposed on the ballot yesterday, and he will be challenged by a Hamilton County Common Pleas judge named Megan Shanahan.
Tom, I'd like you to reiterate what you told me prior to going on air about the number of voters that came out for both former President Trump and President Biden, and what you think that is indicative of.
So we had a turnout of about 1.6 million voters out of 8 million for the election itself. But what was interesting was that Biden got about 564,000 votes, while Trump, in that race, we had 1.1 million votes. Now, Biden won with about 88% of the vote, another 89%. The other 11% went to Dean Phillips, the former congressman from Minnesota. In Trump's case, he got 79% of the vote, and you had another 21% that went to Haley with 14, and then the other three candidates. It was basically Christie, DeSantis, and Ramaswamy, who split the rest of that vote to 3%, et cetera. But what was interesting was just to see that more than double of the vote in that presidential contest was for Republican candidates as opposed to the Democrat. Now, be that as it may, it was technically still an open primary for the Republicans, even though he's sealed the deal on the delegate count. And Biden is the incumbent president, so you expect that kind of difference. But to see a difference of that size and scope, which I think is largely explained by the fact that in the Senate race, you had a three-way race for the Republican nomination and nothing on the Senate side because Brown's the incumbent, Democratic side because Brown's the incumbent.
And Cherie, what do you make of that, including the fact that Nikki Haley did get, what, some 14% of the vote? What are you going to be looking out for when it becomes strength to strength between Trump and Biden as we head into November?
Well, we know it's not going to be a low turnout race in November, right? We know this. We know turnout's going to be high and tensions are going to be heightened. And, you know, and the issues that surrounding this particular Senate race, the issues surrounding this particular presidential race are seen as very, very high stakes. So we know it's going to be higher turnout. So it's hard to predict, right, from the primary, like how things will play out. Other things are in play. For example, a couple weeks ago, Ohio Capital Journal had a piece. There's been a 35% increase in 18-year-olds, not 18 to 29-year-olds, 18-year-olds registering to vote in the state of Ohio. And, you know, we presume that was, I study youth political participation, right? We presume that was those constitutional ballot initiatives. So they were probably registering to vote on either the marijuana or the abortion issue. Will they turn out to vote, right? Will they show up in the general? They're not going to. 18-year-olds, very unlikely to show up in a primary. But they might be mobilized to show up because they're primed to vote on those issues in the general. I couldn't find exit polling on similar exit polling on Biden, but the NBC exit poll, 18% of the primary voters those Haley voters won't support Trump. 10% said they were going to vote for Biden, and 8% said they won't vote at all. So can Biden, you know, there's people who are upset with Biden right now that typically vote for Democrats. Is he more capable of bringing them home than Trump will be? You know, are they a little less sort of solidified in their opposition? I think all of those things combined with a high turnout, high stakes election make it really hard to predict from this primary.
Dr. Cherie Strawn of the Bliss Institute at the University of Akron, State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, and of course, in studio, Dr. Tom Sutton of Baldwin Wallace. Always great to have you on, and thanks so much for this analysis on the day after the primary.
Thank you very much.
Great to be here. Thanks.
If you're looking for specific results, please visit our website, ideastream.org, for results and coverage from the IdeaStream public media news reporters on some of the key local, state, and congressional races. Time now for a break. We'll hear about the efforts to improve health outcomes for Black mothers and babies by addressing perinatal stress. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks for staying with us. Infant mortality rates in Northeast Ohio are 3 to 5 times higher for Black babies than white babies. Those trends are an issue across the country, but are particularly prevalent in this part of the state. Experts at Kent State have found through their research that untreated post-traumatic stress disorder and chronic stress among Black mothers play a critical role in high mortality rates among Black children. That research led Dr. Angela Neal Barnett, a professor in Kent State's Department of Psychological Sciences, to develop and launch the Spirit of Motherhood program back in 2021. Last month, Angela Neal Barnett and Diane Robinson, immediate past president of the Greater Stark County Urban League, spoke about the Spirit of Motherhood program at Bell Tower Brewing in Kent for the latest installment of their Brains on Tap series. Here are Dr. Barnett and Diane Robinson.
When my daughter went away to college, Diane asked me what I was going to do with my time. I told you that I was going to sit on my deck, drink Moscato, and golf. And I was well on my way to executing that plan when a young woman knocked on my office door. "Everybody told me I should come see you," she said. "I'm a founder of a black doula agency, and the researchers tell us that these women have little stress and anxiety. But when they talk to us, they sound highly stressed and anxious. We think the researchers are wrong. Can you help us?" So I thought about it, and I calculated in my tea time, multiplied that by 2, and said yes. How much time could it take? 3 months tops, I thought. 8 years have passed.
My gosh, 20 minutes.
Haven't seen the deck. Moscato's in the fridge. And I'm fairly certain the golf bag is missing. What isn't missing, however, is the importance of perinatal mental health in perinatal health and understanding the role that that plays in maternal morbidity and infant mortality. Didn't take us very long to figure out what was going on. The researchers were finding what they were finding because they didn't take the time to listen to black women. So we decided we were going to listen to them, and we developed Sisters Offering Support Sister Circles, an intervention for stress and anxiety among black pregnant women, where we listen to the women and they listen to each other. And what we found was that when it came to mental health, the women just didn't know. And time again, we heard, "What? You mean this has a name?" We just thought it was the way it was supposed to be. And it turned out that while we were listening, people were listening to us. And so I was approached by the Sisters of Charity to do a grant with pregnant black women in another area of Cleveland. So this time, I didn't even consider the tea time. But what I did consider was the fact that black babies were dying. And when they did, their mothers were left powerless, and that the Prada team had knowledge and we had skills to reverse that trend. And so I said yes. I knew, because I knew the neighborhood we were going into, that I needed someone as dedicated to the community as I was, who would not blink going into an area where angels feared to tread, who knew that if we were going to make a difference in maternal morbidity and infant mortality, we had to work in the places where the women who were at risk were, regardless of where that was. And so I called Diane.
When Dr. Angela called and asked me to work with her on a grant-funded research project regarding the trauma and the problems that black mothers was having, I was intrigued and wanted to hear more. After some discussion, I came to an understanding and knew that there was very little, if any, research regarding stress, anxiety, and trauma with regard to black mothers. With that, I immediately accepted the offer of project coordinator. Within my being, I knew that this research would be a crucial step to identifying the causes of stress and anxiety among Black mothers. I knew this too could help determine the accuracy of the information that was there with regard to the low stress and the anxiety that they were reporting for Black women. We immediately also considered the fact that it would give us an opportunity to evaluate and report that the doulas who were working with these mothers was hearing and reporting back to us. And so it was an easy decision for us to move forward. Now, the funding was there. As you heard Dr. Angela say, Sisters of Charity had approved and approached Dr. Angela, asking her if she would investigate and determine how to best support the needs of these Black women. To begin the research, we worked with doulas from Birthing Beautiful Communities. We worked with them to recruit Black mothers living in the central neighborhoods of Cleveland. We wanted them to participate in the focus group programs and to ensure that we had the number of moms that we needed to conduct meaningful focus groups. We provided incentives. We gave them gift cards. We provided food and transportation and a person to care for their children while they were there at the focus groups. And this was on-site care. And of course, we provided food, toys, coloring books, and all these things for the children. And that was to free the moms so that they would be invested in the focus group and they would share the much needed information so that we could develop programs, interventions that would make a difference for them. It was after the focus group sessions that the Prada team discussed the collected information. And that information was really heartwarming. It was elegantly provided to us, and we knew that we would be able to use that. The focus groups came together, and the Prada team discussed the collected information. And they asked the Urban Ounce of Prevention, a group of counselors, to code the recorded information and review so that we would not just think that we as the Prada team had heard the information, but they confirmed it. The Urban Ounce of Prevention, a group of counselors, coded the information that we received from the focus groups. When we received their report, it confirmed that our original consensus about anxiety and stress was true. But what really stood out was the trauma. Not only the trauma that spoke about the through their eloquent sharing with us, but the trauma and the cortisol said that was in their bodies. So with this cortisol testing of the trauma, it was really exceptionally high. Little did I know that 5 years later and five grants later, I would still be working with this very important project, invested in the work.
And I didn't either. When I made the phone call, I thought, okay, this is just temporary, and until I get a postdoc. Anyway, enough said about that. The psychosocial data was really enlightening, but it was the cortisol data paired with the psychosocial data that was just absolutely compelling. So cortisol is the stress hormone And cortisol behaves a lot like I did when my daughter turned 16. I threw her the keys to the SUV, and I went down to the dealership, and I bought myself a grown woman's car. Now, for those of you who don't know what a grown woman's car is, it only holds grown-ass people. No toys, no dance bags, no instruments, no kids allowed at all. Okay. I wheeled that baby off the lot, jumped on 77 going south, and I drove 77 miles per hour for 77 miles. At the 78th mile, the car started making noise. At the 79th mile, steam rose from the engine. And at the 80th mile, the car just stopped. It would go no further. And that same thing that happened to my grown woman's car is what happens to Black pregnant women, okay? The stressors of interpersonal, systemic, and internalized racism, coupled with the everyday racial microaggressions, shoots up the cortisol. They run like my car, hot. But you can only run hot for so long, and then it just dies. The cortisol becomes what psychologists call blunted. And blunted cortisol places you at risk for anxiety and for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. High cortisol places you at risk for depression. And so as we looked at this data and considered our options and considered the cost to these women, their unborn children, and their families, psychologically and physically, the spirit of motherhood was born. The spirit of motherhood is a three-component intervention. The first component is an individual treatment for PTSD called WET, which stands for written exposure therapy. The second component is a parenting skills sister circle, 5 sessions as well. And the third session, and the third component is a music intervention. And then I thought we were done, but what happened?
They asked for more.
They did. So we developed an infant parenting sister circle, again, 5 sessions. The entire program is delivered in the community by doulas, community health workers, community folks, undergraduate, graduate students, and us, all of whom and our entire team is primarily or mostly Black and biracial. I am not a parenting research expert, so I thought it would be better to bring in a parenting expert to collaborate with our community experts. But in doing so, I failed to listen to the voices of the Black mothers who continue to tell us that if they had had any mental health intervention, it had only been for 1 session because the therapist didn't look like them, didn't appear to be listening to them, and they were fearful that they were plotting to take their children. When I brought in the parenting expert, though, I forgot all those things. And these old fears and feelings resurfaced with our team. Well, Diane, what would you say?
It didn't work. What we learned was that the moms were much more trusting of our Prada team, and they didn't want to work with anyone else. As someone who has always worked in the community and for the community, I understood there were aspects of collaboration that were taken for granted. You see, our Prada team understood the importance of building the relationship with the moms they were working with. With this trust, there was a dedication to including good feedback. And that feedback came from all of the diverse people that made up the team for Prada. And it really built the relationship so that the moms would trust, and they did this by consistently tailoring the interventions that we had based upon what the moms said they needed. It was also important to understand that the community we were working within communicated their hardships through stories. And what we needed our team to do was to listen to the stories. The stories within the lives of the Black women. We found the keys to the components of the spirit of motherhood by storytelling, and with us listening to the individuals, we then utilized that information. Storytelling then became a very critical component to our parenting classes, and when developing the Parenting Sister Circle curriculum, we collaborated with a videographer, media consultant, and musicians who produced video series on topics such as reaching out for help, the importance of knowing how to change a diaper, safe sleep, managing stress, and managing conflict using music and role play scenarios. The music continued the stories and was therapy for the children that took part.
We were so proud of what we had done. The program was excellent, and the mothers confirmed that. But unlike the field of dreams, just because you build it doesn't mean they will come. There has to be order and symmetry and purpose to what you do, and it must be disseminated consistently within the communities. So we are never in the office. We are always in the communities, at community events, and we're embedded in your stomping grounds, the Urban Leagues of Northeast Ohio, working with the underserved. And the spirit of motherhood has been successful. That's not just me talking or Diane talking. The data shows it. We've reduced PTSD symptoms by 50 to 100%. And we've seen those gains, thank you. And we've seen those gains in 3 month and 6 month follow-ups. We've reduced parenting stress by 25%. And more importantly, we've listened to Black women. They trust us. They trust us to the point that they ask for more ways to be involved in their mental health. But more importantly, we've learned to trust them. Yes. And that's, I think that's the real beauty of partnering with the community and working together as experts. As a mother, I want more for my child than I had for myself. That's the same thing our Black mothers want, that and to live to see their child's first birthday and that the child lived to see his or her first birthday. Because in Northeast Ohio, and in fact, across America, that is not the case. Diane always says to me that the spirit of motherhood is more than an intervention. And on my good days, I think she's right. We've watched this program unfold, and it has impacted positively on the mothers, their babies, their preschoolers, their families, their communities, and even policy. More importantly, I think, Diane, that we've witnessed hope, which psychologists tell us is the key to healing. When the mother enters the spirit of motherhood, she comes with the hope that maybe something different will occur. Maybe this time it'll work. And when she leaves the program, she leaves knowing that hope never, ever disappoints.
That was Dr. Angela Neal Barnett and Diane Robinson speaking about the creation of their Spirit of Motherhood program aimed at improving the health outcomes from Black mothers and their children. It was part of the Brains on Tap lecture series that happens quarterly at Bell Tower Brewery in Kent. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, we're going to discuss the impact artificial intelligence, or AI, is having on our healthcare systems and medicine generally. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening today, and I will speak with you again tomorrow.